Chapter 12. Juan settled the earbud of his radio a little deeper and tapped the throat mic to let the others know he was in position. Below him lay the responsivist compound, a collection of rambling buildings surrounded by a whitewashed cement block wall. Behind the compound was a rocky beach with a single wooden jetty running 100 feet into the Gulf of Corinth. With the tide just coming back in, he could smell the water on the soft breeze. The buildings were low slung, as if clinging to the ground, reminding Cabrillo of the work of Frank Lloyd Wright. The shallow roofs were covered in barrel tile that looked black through his third-generation night vision goggles, but he knew from their pre-launch briefing the tiles were red clay. The lawns within the compound were burned brown from a drought, and the leaves on the few gnarled olive trees were dried husks. It was 3:30 in the morning, and the only lights showing were affixed to strategically placed poles. He turned his attention to the wall. It stood 10 feet high and was a double layer of thick cement blocks, running for nearly 800 feet on a side. As was the custom in this part of the world, upright glass shards had been embedded in the top of the wall to deter intruders. Earlier in the day, he and Linda had gone to the only security company in the nearby town of Corinth, posing as an American couple who'd just purchased an oceanside house and wanted to install an alarm system. The store's owner boasted he'd done extensive work for the responsivists, pointing to an autographed 8x10 glossy of Donna Skye as if it were proof. The tripwire running atop the wall was one of the first things Juan observed when he got into position. Next came the cameras, and by the time his team had finished counting, they had spotted 13 on the exterior of the buildings alone. They could only assume there were more inside. There was a single rolling gate bisecting the stone driveway, and another smaller gate at the back of the facility in line with the jetty. A pair of chain-link fences jutted from the compound walls and out into the sea to prevent people walking along the shore from trespassing on responsivist property. Although the security measures weren't particularly overt, it did give the complex a forbidding aura. But not from the outside, Juan reflected. It didn't look as though the place was designed to keep people out, but rather to keep them in. He scoped the grounds between the buildings once again. 3 jeeps were parked in front of the main building. A thermal scan showed their engines were cold. There were no guards patrolling the paths crisscrossing the compound, no roving dogs, and the cameras mounted under eaves and on the light poles remained stationary. It was likely that there was a manned security station inside one of the buildings with a guard staring at a bank of monitors, which was why Cabrillo had the advance team keep watch from the moment they could be choppered from the Oregon to Athens. Link and Eddie had needed only 2 hours, sitting across the coast road in an olive grove overlooking the facility, to map out the camera's blind spots and transmit that information back to the ship. They had estimated that there were currently about 45 responsivists inside, although there were enough buildings to house twice that number in relative comfort. With their strategy worked out ahead of time and final tactics honed, the crew had spent the day putting everything into place, securing rental cars, scouting escape routes, and finding a suitable place nearby for George Adams to land the Robinson and transfer Kyle to the General Aviation Apron at Athens's Eleftherios Venizelos International Airport. Chuck Gunderson already had the corporation's Gulfstream executive jet prepped for the quick flight to Rome. All the paperwork had been filed, and a limousine was waiting for them at the other end. And if things didn't go as smoothly as planned, they had alternatives ready to go at an instant's notice. The details were so meticulous that Eric Stone, aboard the Oregon, who had been studying the tidal charts, had determined the precise moment they should commence their covert assault. Although Cabrillo was taking a role in the snatch and grab, Eddie Seng, as chief of shore operations, would lead the 4-person attack, and it was his responsibility to make sure everyone involved was ready. 1 minute from my mark, Juan heard him whisper over the radio. Mark. Juan tapped his transmit button in acknowledgement. He tested the pair of quick-draw holsters hanging from his hips, making certain the pair of compact Glock 19s came out easily. Though he favored the new Fabrique Nationale 5.7 automatic as his personal sidearm, because the small 5.7mm bullets could defeat nearly any flak jackets, this mission wasn't about killing. The crew in the ship's armory had soft-loaded the Glock's 9mm rounds with half their normal charge, and it topped them not with lead bullets, but ballistic plastic. At close range, the bullets could be deadly, but at anything beyond 15 feet, the non-lethal shells would take the fight out of the average person with a single hit. The seconds trickled by, and, as if a sign from above, clouds slid over the quarter moon, turning the night inky. Faintly, Juan could hear the throb of the Robinson R-44 as Gomez Adams got into position. "You ready?" he asked Mark Murphy, who was hunkered down next to him in the same roadside ditch. "Two missions in 3 days," Mark breathed. His face was streaked with camo paint, and his long hair was tucked into a black bandana. "I think you've got it in for me. Consider yourself our resident combat hacker." Cabrillo glanced at his sleeve. Embedded in the fabric was a tiny, flexible computer screen. The e-paper's resolution was crystal clear, and the image it showed was the responsivist's compound from an altitude of 1,000 feet. Linda Ross was in a van down the road at the controls of their UAV. With the camera zoomed in, Juan had an unobstructed view of the facility, but more important, he would know the location of anyone walking the grounds. The experimental view screen was giving off too much light, so he turned down the gain until it was a muted glow. The rig's batteries and computer were sewn into the back of his combat vest. "Let's go," Juan heard Eddie say. He tapped Murph on the shoulder, and they ran across the road together, their soft-soled boots making no sound on the macadam. When they reached the cement block wall, Cabrillo turned so that his back was toward it and cupped his hands. Mark stepped up onto Juan's palms and then, with a boost, onto his shoulders. Mark almost made the mistake of grasping the top of the wall to steady himself, but stopped just before he shredded his hands on the glass. He paused for a moment to let the chairman find his center of balance. Had Mark not known it was there, the monofilament security tripwire was nearly impossible to see. It ran along the perimeter of the wall, less than half an inch from the edge, supported by dozens of tiny insulators. If he were to guess, he'd say that less than 10 pounds of pressure would cut the wire and trigger the alarm. He pulled a voltmeter from a pouch at his hip to test the current flowing through the delicate wire. He selected an appropriate pair of alligator clamps and attached them to the wire, letting 3 feet of line dangle over the far side of the wall. With his bypass in place, he snipped the wire, wincing unconsciously in case he'd gotten it wrong. There were no raised cries, no klaxons, and no lights snapped on in any of the buildings. From another pouch, he unfurled a roll of carbon fiber cloth and settled it over the top of the wall. Mark heaved himself atop the wall, and even with his full weight bearing down on the razor-sharp glass, it couldn't cut through the high-tech material. He dropped down to the ground and moved slightly to his left. A moment later, he heard Juan scramble up and over the wall. He fell lightly at Mark's side. "When we're back on the ship, you're going on a diet," Juan said, but showed no ill effects of holding Murph aloft. He keyed his throat mic. "We're in." On the opposite side of the compound, where there was another gap in the video camera coverage, Eddie and Franklin Lincoln were making their covert entrance. Though Link was the best the corporation had at security bypasses, it had been Eddie who cut the wire for the simple reason that all the martial arts training in the world couldn't give him the strength to hold Link's 250-pound frame. "So are we. Standing by." Keeping flat, Cabrillo led Murph away from the wall, snaking across the grounds in a seemingly random pattern, but the route had been carefully mapped out so they avoided the numerous cameras. At one end of the main building, the roof sported several satellite dishes and a spindly radio transmission tower. This was their destination, and it took 7 minutes of crawling to reach it. Juan removed his goggles, and cupping his hands around his eyes, pressed his face to a window. There was a dim smear of light near the back wall, the glow of a computer on standby mode. The pre-raid reconnaissance had confirmed that this was the camp director's office. He noted an alarm pod attached to the window sash that would trip if the window was opened. He pulled the device from his combat vest, and when he aimed it at the alarm, an indicator glowed red. Next, he swept the device along the glass to determine if wires had been embedded between the two panes, but the device remained dark. If this was the level of security provided by Corinth's finest company, he considered making a career change to Greek cat burglar. He attached two small suction cups to the glass and then scored the window with a cutter, moving slowly so the sound of the pane being sliced never rose above a rough hiss. He heard an audible sigh when the vacuum between the two pieces of insulated glass were released. He handed the cutter to Mark and carefully pulled the pane free of the frame with the suction cups. He repeated the process with the inner piece of glass and set it on the floor inside the office when he was finished. Juan legged over the sill and ducked into the building. When Mark had scrambled through the window, Cabrillo drew down the shade. "We're in the office." "Roger," Eddie replied. Juan gestured to the computer. "It's up to you." Murph cracked his knuckles and took a seat behind the desk, turning down the screen before waking the system. From a fanny pack, he removed a battered piece of electronics covered in decals and wads of dried gum. He jacked it into the computer's USB port. A moment later, a laughing skull appeared on the monitor. When it disappeared, Mark began to pound the keyboard with one ambidextrous hand while the other rolled the mouse like a child would a toy truck. Juan left him to his work and examined the office using a tiny penlight, making certain he stayed away from the window in case there was a gap around the shade. They had learned from the responsivist's website that the facility's director was another Californian named Gil Martel. A little digging showed that Martel had sold luxury automobiles in Beverly Hills prior to his joining the group, and that his name had come up several times in an investigation of a car theft ring. Although he was charged, several key witnesses vanished back to Mexico before the trial, and the indictment was dropped. The room's furniture was what Cabrillo expected. Desk, credenza, a couple of chairs, a sofa along one wall with a coffee table. He recognized it was all expensive. The oriental rug under the coffee table was a flat-weave antique kilim that would fetch a considerable price at auction. Framed photographs adorned the walls, Martel's shrine to himself. Juan didn't know some of the people smiling into the camera with Martel, while others were easily recognizable. He spotted several with Donna Skye. Even in these candid shots, the movie star's beauty was undeniable. With her dark hair, almond eyes, and the sharpest cheekbones in the business, she was the epitome of Hollywood royalty. Cabrillo wondered idly what part of her life was so miserable that she would allow a cult to take it over. Another picture caught his attention. It was an older photograph of Martel and another man on the deck of a sailboat. It was signed, "Keep the Faith," Lydell Cooper. The snapshot must have been taken shortly before Cooper vanished at sea on his catch. He'd read the Coast Guard report, and it appeared that the boat simply capsized in a storm that had come out of nowhere. Five other small craft had also been caught unaware, and an additional three people drowned. If Juan could use a single word to describe the scientist-turned-prophet, it would be bland. There was nothing distinguishable about Cooper. He was in his mid to late 60s, paunchy, with an egg-shaped head, glasses, and a hairline in full retreat. His eyes were a plain brown, and the gray beard and mustache neither added to nor took away from his appearance. It was as if the facial hair was expected on a retired researcher, and he'd grown it out of obligation. Juan saw nothing that could inspire thousands to join his crusade. No charisma, no charm, none of the things that would attract followers at all. Had he not known what Cooper looked like, he could have guessed Martel kept a picture of his accountant on his wall. "Got it," Murph cried, then looked around guiltily for speaking so loudly.
"Sorry. I'm into their system. Piece of cake."
Juan strode across the room.
"Can you find which room is Kyle's?"
"They have everything cross-referenced. He's in Building C, which is the newest one right near where Eddie and Link climbed the wall. Kyle Hanley's room is number 117, but he's not alone. He's got a roommate named, let's see, Jeff Ponsetto. Well done, Cabrillo said, and relayed the information to Eddie and Link. Start to download what you can off their computer. Linda Ross came over the tactical net. Chairman, check your view screen. You've got company coming. Juan glanced at his sleeve. Two men dressed in maintenance workers' overalls were crossing the compound. They carried toolboxes and appeared to be heading toward the main building, where he and Murph were. Had there been some sort of emergency call to the engineering staff, surely they would have heard voices. Whatever was going on, Cabrillo didn't like it. Murph, forget the download. Let's go. As Juan went toward the door, he tucked an electronic bug under the desk lamp. He knew it would be found quickly once the break-in was detected, but it would transmit the first critical moments of whatever took place in Gil Martel's office. He paused at the window and checked the view screen once again. The maintenance workers were approaching the building's front door, which gave him and Mark the time they needed to get clear. He slowly opened the shade and eased himself over the window sash. His Glock was in his hand, though he had no conscious memory of drawing it. Keeping low and following their carefully laid map to avoid the cameras, they moved toward Building C. The grass was dry under their shoes and crackled with each step. Like the others in the responsivist compound, Building C was one-storied, with whitewashed walls and a barrel-tile roof. Link and Eddie were pressed to the wall next to a door, out of view of the camera mounted above it. A security keypad was to the right, and its faceplate had been removed and left dangling by a bunch of wires. Link had already installed his bypass. Despite having such large hands, the former Navy SEAL was the best lockpick the corporation had, and he worked his tools with the delicate touch of a brain surgeon. With a pick and torsion rod in place, he gave the lock a jerk to the left, and the door snicked open.
14 seconds, Eddie whispered.
The maestro strikes again. Link smirked and stepped into a long hallway running the length of the building. The hall was lined with dozens of identical doors and was illuminated by shaded fluorescent fixtures hanging from the ceiling. The carpeting was an institutional gray, not much softer than the concrete slab on which the building was constructed. The four men started down, peering into a large kitchen to their left and a room lined with a dozen commercial washing machines to their right. Juan didn't see any clothes dryers and assumed they had drying lines behind the building. Part of responsivism was to reduce one's impact on the natural world, so not having dryers fit their beliefs, as did the solar panels they'd spied on the roof of one of the buildings. They quickly found room 117. Link reached up to remove the cover over the closest light fixture and pulled the fluorescent tubes from their brackets. The four donned night vision goggles, and Juan turned the doorknob. The room beyond looked like a typical dorm room, with two metal-framed beds, a pair of desks, and matching bureaus. The adjoining bathroom was a small tiled enclosure, with a drain on the floor for the shower. In the eerie green cast of the goggles, shapes were indeterminate, and colors washed out to shades of black, but the silhouettes of people sleeping on the beds were unmistakable. So was the snoring. Eddie pulled a small plastic case from the thigh pocket of his fatigue pants. Inside were four hypodermic needles. The narcotic cocktail inside the barrels would incapacitate a grown man in under 20 seconds. Because Kyle had willingly joined the cult, he would surely resist their efforts to get him out. The deprogrammer, Adam Jenner, had recommended drugging the youth to Linda when they'd spoken, although Juan had planned to do it even without the advice. Eddie gave a needle to Cabrillo and approached one of the beds. The man was sleeping on his stomach, his face turned to the wall. In a fluid movement, Seng clamped his hand around the man's mouth and slid the needle into his neck, his thumb coming down on the plunger with even pressure. Across the room, Juan did the same thing. His victim came instantly awake and bucked against Juan's arm, his eyes wide with panic. Juan held him down easily, even when the man's legs began to thrash. Juan counted down from 20 in his head. When he reached 10, the man's gyrations were slowing, and when he hit 3, the guy was totally still. Juan flashed his penlight into the man's face. Although Kyle Hanley took after his mother, Juan saw enough of Max in the boy to know it was him.
Got him.
As a precaution, Link whipped flexi-cuffs around Kyle's ankles and wrists before tossing him over his shoulder.
All set, big man? Juan asked.
Link grinned in the darkness. I carried your sorry butt for 8 miles in Cambodia 3 years ago, so this boy's nothing. Can't weigh but 120. Cabrillo checked the e-paper screen on his sleeve. Everything looked quiet, but he radioed Linda for confirmation.
The janitors are still in the main building.
A light came on across the compound from where you are, but went out again 1:08 later.
Pit stop. My guess, too. You're clear for extraction.
Roger. He turned to his team.
We're good to go.
A bell began shrieking just as they started back down the corridor. It sounded like a fire alarm, a shrill, piercing sound that pounded on their eardrums like daggers. There was no way to communicate over the din, but the men were seasoned professionals and knew what was expected of them. Eddie was in the lead, followed closely by Link and Mark. All three men accelerated down the hallway, any attempt at stealth forgotten. This was no longer a snatch and grab, but a race to the perimeter wall, where, if Link and Eddie had done as ordered, a limpet mine was in place to blast through the blocks. Linda Ross was near enough to hear the klaxon and would be on the radio instructing George Adams to bring the Robinson in for a fast extraction. He'd land directly on the road and would have the team aboard before any guards knew what had happened. A door to one side of Juan flew open, and a sleepy-eyed man wearing pajama bottoms stepped into the corridor. Cabrillo slammed his elbow into the man's jaw, spiraling him to the carpet in a rubbery heap. Ahead, another man poked his head out of his dormitory room. Even with the dead weight of Kyle Hanley on his shoulder, Link juked sideways and stiff-armed the responsivist. The man's head hit the metal doorframe, and as Juan raced past, the man's eyes rolled into his head until only the whites shone. He collapsed backward like a felled tree. Eddie instinctively paused when they reached the exterior door. Juan checked the video feed on his sleeve, but Linda must have been occupied with Adams because the circling drone's camera showed nothing but the ocean just north of them. He could hear her girlish voice in his radio's earbud, but the alarm was too loud to make out her words. All he caught was her strident tone. He shrugged at the lack of intel and opened the door, leading with his Glock. With the exception of alarms sounding across the compound, everything looked as tranquil as before. There were no rushing guards or any movement at all. It didn't even appear that additional lights had come on. Clear of the sonic avalanche of the bell inside the dormitory, Juan pressed his hands to his ears to try to hear what Linda was shouting.
Out of there! Guards on the far side! Gomez is coming in! Hurry!
He was fumbling for his night vision goggles when a trio of men in gray uniforms appeared around the corner of a nearby building. Juan took a fraction of a second too long to see if they were armed. One of them opened up with a compact submachine gun, spraying an arc of bullets that blew plaster dust into the air as the rounds dug into the dormitory. Cabrillo dropped flat and fired. His aim was perfect, hitting the guard's center mass, but rather than going down, the man simply staggered back a bit.
Inside!
He shouted to his team and crawled into the corridor once again, closing the door with his foot. He screamed to be heard over the alarm.
They've got automatics and Kevlar vests. Our plastic bullets don't even slow them down.
Talk about bringing a knife to a gunfight, Eddie yelled. A fresh barrage of auto fire tore at the building's facade, seemingly shaking the entire structure. Link jammed a chair under the door handle so it couldn't be opened from outside, then reached up the wall and tore the horn off its mount, silencing it. More like a blowgun to an artillery duel, my friend.